All right, well, again, welcome. My name is Joshua Chestnut. Tonight we're going to be talking about Fred Rogers, or Mr. Rogers. I had entitled this something else, but I've changed the title just yesterday. So there are many ways to say I love you, which is one of Mr. Rogers' original songs. We're going to be hearing some of those songs this evening, both him singing them as well as a live rendition or two. Just one. But as a way into this, I want to tell a story that I think captures something of the character of Mr. Rogers. And the story actually takes place here in Boston, even though technically we're in Metro West, but we're sort of Boston area. But Mr. Rogers was in town for an important set of meetings at WGBH, the National Public Broadcasting in Boston. And one night, there was this very exclusive dinner party at the home of one of the executives at WGBH. This was a big deal party, it was catered, private event, and a limo driver, a guy named Billy, was supposed to pick up Mr. Rogers, bring him to the party, come back once the party was done, and then bring Mr. Rogers back to his hotel. Simple thing. Now, my father drove limos for a number of years, and he's told me a few things about people who drive limos. The first is people usually don't aspire to be limo drivers. This is not something that ends up on your CV. This is not something that you're necessarily proud of, but it's a way to make a little extra money, often on the side. The hours aren't great or reliable. They change quite frequently. Your customers have little to no incentive to treat you well. And it's just, you spend a lot of time in a car, in traffic, at the airport, so it's a high anxiety job. And so on normal evenings, my father said, on normal nights, people pay little attention to you. They just want to get from the airport or from wherever they're going back to their home. It was a normal night. And I would assume for Billy, the limo driver in Boston, that was what many nights were like. But this night with Mr. Rogers was slightly different. So he picks up Mr. Rogers, and instead of putting that window up and sort of barricading himself in the back to get a couple moments of quiet to himself, Mr. Rogers is super curious about Billy. Where do you come from, Billy? How long have you been a limousine driver? Do you like driving limousines? All these sorts of questions. And so by the time they get to this party, this really important dinner party, Billy says to him, as this protocol, what time should I be back to pick you up? And without missing a beat, Mr. Rogers says, you don't have to go anywhere. Just come with me. You can be my guest of honor. I'm the guest at this dinner party. Why don't you just join me? So Billy says, okay. Sure. And so in his little kind of, his little limousine driver tux, he accompanies Mr. Rogers to this party to the bewilderment of the hosts of this party, who are not expecting that their honored guest, Mr. Rogers, would bring his limo driver, really anybody with him. And so the night's done, and Mr. Rogers is being driven home by Billy. He's now sitting in the front seat. He's not even sitting in the back. Talking to him. And he finds out that Billy still lives at home with his parents. And that in his parents' house, which is in West Roxbury, his parents' house has a piano. Mr. Rogers loves the piano. And he loves parents. So he says, maybe I could come over and meet your parents and play the piano for you. And so, as though he's done it 1,000 times, Mr. Rogers comes over, plays the piano, and entertains Billy and Billy's family on this night that is very different from most other nights. Incredibly different than a normal night for Billy. And actually, the story doesn't end there with Billy and Mr. Rogers. And this is all recounted from one of Mr. Rogers' assistants who was with them the whole night. But a few years later, Billy came down with cancer, which ultimately took his life. And when he was alone in the hospital, one day he received a phone call. This is 5 years, at least, after the evening. And it's Mr. Rogers. And he's calling because he's heard Billy is sick. He wants to pray for him. Wants to catch up a little bit, and he wants to say goodbye. He's a very different sort of client, Mr. Rogers. He's a different person. C.S. Lewis, towards the end of his book, Mere Christianity, writes about one of the key paradoxes of the Christian faith. that as we submit our lives to Jesus, we become more like Jesus. But at the same time, we actually become more like ourselves. So he says this, Lewis says this. He says, sameness is to be found most among the most natural of people, but not among those who surrender to Christ. How monotonously alike all the great tyrants and conquerors of history have been, but how gloriously different are the saints. So perhaps a better word to describe Billy's evening with Mr. Rogers is not just different from other nights, but gloriously different. Because he was with someone who had been transformed by Christ. And so Fred Rogers, or Mr. Rogers, is most well known as the creator and the namesake of this American TV show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which aired for over 30 years on public broadcasting, targeted to young kids, kind of 3 to 5, and at its height, it was watched by millions of people each day. By nearly all accounts, Fred was an extremely successful person. Not only did he have the attention and loyalty of millions of daily viewers, whom he called his television neighbors, he was an ordained Presbyterian minister, and his ordination was to minister to children, in particular, children of all faiths, but through television. This is a very peculiar calling. But not on top of those things, throughout his career, he received a Presidential Medal of Freedom. He was given over 40 honorary degrees. He received a Peabody Award, a Lifetime Achievement Emmy, and was inducted into the TV Hall of Fame. Not only that, he has several buildings in the state of Pennsylvania named after him, as well as an asteroid. And I was hoping our friend Richard from Townsend would be here, because he might know this asteroid. Number 26858 is the number if you need to look it up. And it's understandable that people were and still are drawn to Mr. Rogers. Just a couple recent examples. Last year, there was an amazing, wonderful documentary, which I really encourage you to see. A lot of what I'm saying tonight overlaps with this, called Won't You Be My Neighbor, about him. A very successful, well-received documentary. Look for it, I think, in the Academy Awards for documentaries next year. And even more interesting, America's most beloved actor, Tom Hanks, is currently filming a movie where he is playing America's most beloved television children's host, and might become the most beloved successful movie of the summer of 2020. So keep an eye out for that. So people are still intrigued with Mr. Rogers. And I think part of it is, as and hopefully this becomes clearer, or you see this yourself as we go through his life, there is this tangible sense of human excellence to this person. There's all these admirable aspects to his life that we'll see. But many, if not all of them, sorry, I'm getting a little confused in my notes here. There's a lot of things about him that I think he embodies human excellence, things we can admire and aspire to ourselves. Some of them are things that for most of us in this room are things we can aspire to, but we most likely will never get to. We won't have the influence. We won't have millions of people watching us every day. We won't have the celebrity or fame that Rogers had. And kind of famously, Mr. Rogers said, fame is a four-letter word. And he said, it's just like tape or face or pain or life or love. What ultimately matters is what you do with it. That's another sort of like little window into Mr. Rogers. But there are things about his life, even if we can't be as famous and well-known and as beloved as him, there are other aspects of human excellence that are on display in his life that can be a part of my life and be a part of your life. So this is part of my hope for this evening, that the example of a life lived well, not perfectly, but lived well, will inspire us, will instruct us, will prompt us, will expand our imaginations about what is possible for us and the lives we've been given. David Brooks, in his book, The Road to Character, writes this. David Brooks is a New York Times columnist. He writes, "Example is the best teacher. Moral improvement, and I would also add spiritual formation, occurs most reliably when the heart is warmed, when we come into contact with people we admire and love, and we consciously and unconsciously bend our lives to mimic theirs." And so in our culture, you hear mimic, or maybe imitation, and it has a negative connotation. Who wants to eat imitation crab? No one. Who wants to sit on a pleather couch, or at least brag about a pleather couch? But when it comes to being human, when it comes to living the lives we have, philosopher James K.A. Smith reminds us that we learn to be virtuous by imitating exemplars of justice, compassion, kindness, and love. And we see this in the pages of the New Testament. The Apostle Paul exhorts the Corinthians to be imitators. He says, "Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ." And being an imitator, following after exemplars, people who embody human excellence to us, takes work and attention and grace and time. But it gets at a truth about being human that I think doesn't always sit well in our broader culture. And that's that great people are not born. Great people are made through countless daily and seemingly unimportant choices. How they deal with life's inevitable disappointments, how they deal with suffering, their own and other suffering, how they navigate difficult relationships, what they do with what they're given. And in his final commencement address, he gave lots of commencement addresses, Mr. Rogers, and this one was up at Dartmouth College. He gave this in 2002, about a year before he died. He said something that kind of gets at this. He says this, "I'm very much interested in choices and what it is and who it is that enables us human beings to make the choices we all make through our lives. What choices lead to ethnic cleansing? What choices lead to healing? What choices lead to the destruction of the environment, the erosion of the Sabbath, suicide bombings, or teenagers shooting teachers? But also, what choices encourage heroism in the midst of chaos?" So Mr. Rogers was a man who made many choices. We'll see some of the choices he made daily in his life. And it shaped who he was and how he understood what it meant to be a neighbor, a human vocation that he inherited from his Christian faith. And a longtime friend and colleague of Mr. Rogers said the following about him after his death, which happened in 2003. And it captures something about this. So this is his friend Elliot Davis, Daly, who worked with him. He said, "I would describe Fred as the ultimate what you see is what you get, with one exception. What most people couldn't see in Fred was his enormous power." Power. Capital P, power. "Fred is the most powerful person I have ever known. I've dealt with a lot of people whom the world regards as powerful, but none of them could hold a candle to Fred's power. His power derived from a really unique place. It was his absolute self-possession, which is very different from self-interest or self-satisfaction or selfishness. He didn't need anything from you or from me, but he welcomed it. But he didn't need it." And I think that gets into something about what it means that as we become more like Christ, we become more like ourselves. He was someone who became himself. And he chose, as he became himself, to serve the least of these, particularly children. He cared deeply for children. We're going to see this throughout his life. This arose a lot from his Christian faith. And there's a historian named O.M. Backe. He's a Norwegian historian who's written a book called When Children Became People: The Birth of Childhood in Early Christianity. And to summarize his argument is basically that prior to the Christian revolution that happened in the first few centuries of the first couple centuries, he says children were considered virtually non-persons in Greek and Roman society. They had no significance and they weren't worth time and attention. And so Fred is very much, his love for children, his care for children, and his life committed to working with children really comes downstream from this Christian revolution. And so he shows this power that his colleague talks about, not through brute strength, not through towering intelligence, and he was a very intelligent man, not through sexual prowess or wealth or sophistication, but his power was shown through small, simple acts of love and acts of neighborliness. Matters, things that we're also able to choose ourselves. So looking at his life, his faith, his work with children, his understanding of what it means to be a neighbor tonight, I hope this evening is in part kind of generative for our imaginations about what sort of life is possible for us. Because it's easy to hear stories of great people and think, oh, that was them. That was just a special person, a unique person. But I think Fred's life shows that there's lots of the greatness that he exemplifies, that he embodies, is available to us. So we're going to look at his life, and I'm going to structure his evening this evening through looking at some of his songs. He wrote lots and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs for kids that were on his show. So the first song is called What Do You Do With the Mad You Feel? We're going to look at the early years of his life up until the time Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood came on the air. From there, we're going to look at a song called There Are Many Ways to Say I Love You. And I'm going to attempt to kind of exegete or kind of look underneath an average episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And to see that there are many ways that he tried to say, I love you, to his television neighbors. And then we're going to finish with a song called It's You I Like. And he wrote lots of other songs. And just to give you a sense of some of the songs he wrote, some of my favorites are B-O-X Spells Box. You Can Never Go Down the Drain, which is a song that, like, kids, don't worry, when the water goes down the tub, you won't go with it. A song that is really beautiful called Do You Know It's All Right to Wonder? He's talking about wondering at the world. He's saying you're actually learning as you're wondering. Another song called I Just Love Tomatoes. And then another one, When a Baby Comes to Your House, which is when you get a new sibling or when a baby comes over. But the first song we're going to talk about is What Do You Do With the Mad You Feel, a song that was sung 38 times on the show. That's the thing, too. He played these songs multiple times. And we're in for a treat. Our own Ben Kies is going to come play it for us. And if you can see, I hope you can see the words, they're up on the screen.
I'm not going to even attempt to imitate Fred Rogers. It's just going to be something different. What do you do with the man that you feel when you feel so? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong, and nothing you do seems available. What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up your friends for a game of tag and see how fast you can go? It's great to be able to stop when you play. That's wrong. Be able to do something else instead. Sing this song. I can stop when I want to. I can stop when I wish. I can stop, stop, stop anytime. And what a good feeling. Thank you.
thank you, Ben. That was awesome. That was wonderful. But so Fred McFeely Rogers was born March 20th, 1928 in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. That's western Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, to Jim and Nancy McFeely Rogers. It was a very difficult labor, and the doctor said, you shouldn't have another kid. So Fred Rogers, or Freddie, grew up alone with no other siblings, but he was much beloved by his parents, and his mother probably smothered him a little bit with affection and just wanted to hold him close. He was a cherished child and remained an only child until he was 11, when his parents adopted a little sister. So he's 11, and then he has a little sister, Nancy Elizabeth Rogers, or Lainey. But though he was deeply loved, isolation was a common experience in Fred, or Freddie's, early years. Freddie was often sick, which leads to an interesting fact about the McFeely Rogers clan, that they were the first family in Latrobe to buy an air conditioner. And they needed an air conditioner because Fred had asthma, and the hot, humid air of western Pennsylvania in the summers was hard for him to breathe. So an air conditioner was a great gift because he could breathe, but it kept him inside while other kids were outside playing. And buying the first air conditioner in town wasn't out of character for the Rogers clan, because they were very wealthy. They were part of the elite of western Pennsylvania. Fred's father, Jim, managed multiple factories, and while they were very well-to-do, they were also extremely generous and warm as a family. Jim made it a point to know all his employees by name, and after he passed, there was a ledger discovered in his desk that he had loaned out thousands and thousands of dollars, his own money, to his employees who needed loans, and many of them had not gone collected, and most likely were given knowing that it wasn't going to come back to him. So though they were very wealthy, they were a generous family. They were rich financially, but in all accounts, they were rich with affection in the home. Freddie's grandparents were a very present part of his life, especially his namesake, his grandfather, Fred Sr., who Mr. Rogers often said, he would say, Freddie, you have made my day special, very special. You can sort of, you'll hear some of that later in Mr. Rogers as an adult. And Fred Sr. was the counterbalance. If his mother was smothering and overprotective, Fred Sr. was often pushing him out into the world, challenging him to grow. They were also a devout Christian family, lifelong members of the local Presbyterian church. And Fred recalls a robust spirituality in the home. They were very involved with mercy and justice work through their church. But of all the stories from Fred's youth, from Freddie's youth, that kind of makes sense of his adult years, one stands out, and he's spoken about it many times in interviews, and it's in most books that speak about him. And to get a little picture, the Rogers family had a chauffeur, Grant Ross, and Grant would pick up Freddie twice a day from school, both at the end of the school day to bring him home, but also at lunch. And Fred would go home to the Rogers mansion and eat a lunch by himself that was made by the family chef. And he would eat it alone in the attic. But in the attic, as he ate alone, he would play with puppets that he himself made in a little homemade puppet theater that he'd also made. So there's simultaneously this interesting moments of early creativity and expression, but also deep, deep loneliness. But one day things were different. For some reason, school was let out early and Grant wasn't there to pick up Freddie. And at this point, Freddie was chubby, and he decided to walk home. He didn't live far from school, and he started walking, and he realized some older kids were following him. And so he picked up his pace, and he realized they picked up their pace. So he started running full steam, and they were running full steam. And they started yelling, Fat Freddy, Fat Freddy, Fat Freddy. And he was frightened. He was totally, totally afraid. And he was able to duck into a neighbor's house, Mrs. Stewart, who took him in, called home. Grant, the chauffeur, was able to come and get him. But this image of what that stuck with him you get a stark image of a frightened, sensitive, highly vulnerable, and isolated young boy. And the response he got to this particular situation, as well as other sort of situations like it, of bullying throughout his young years, was more or less, you should just let on that you don't care. Just let on that you don't care, and no one's going to bother you. But the problem for Freddie was that he did care. He cared quite a bit. And so he had a hard time accepting to deny either a difficult reality and also the feelings that that difficult reality brought up in him. And this experience, you see sort of two themes that are going to be a part of Fred's work with children as he gets older. The importance of not avoiding the difficult nature of reality, but also the legitimacy of human emotions. Not all emotions are neutral, but many of them are. And we need to learn what to do with them. So we see this emerging early in his life. Now you fast forward many, many years, and Fred is a senior in college. We've skipped over a lot of time. But he's home in Pennsylvania. He's in college. He goes to Rollins College in Florida, where he studies music composition. And he's home, and for the first time in his life, he sees a television. And he says this: "I saw people dressed in some kind of costumes, literally throwing pies in each other's faces. I was astounded at that." And being astounded is both, in part, being appalled. He's bothered by it, but he's also kind of amazed. He sees that TV could be an extraordinarily powerful tool for education, and he kind of wants in on this. And so he speaks of it as almost something of a calling. He wanted to do something for children. He'd known that for a while, something educational. And it took a while for it to emerge, but he realized he wanted to do educational TV that didn't just talk about cognitive development and learning ideas, learning your numbers and your ABCs. He also wanted to deal with emotional and social development. How do kids process their emotions? How do kids deal with a difficult world? And so, as you could imagine, when he tells his parents this, I want to have a kids show on television, the decision wasn't well received by his parents, in particular his father. His biographer, Roger's biographer, Maxwell King, in this relatively recent biography that was put out, it's quite a good read. It'll be in our library. I like it. I think Maxwell King, the biographer, does not understand Roger's spiritual life particularly well. So that's one just side note of the book. But Maxwell King says this about this moment for Fred. Although Fred's decision might seem like a spur-of-the-moment reaction on the part of a college senior trying to figure out what to do with his life, in fact, it was something much more deliberate. Fred Rogers had been interested in all sorts of things: in religion, in becoming a minister, in music composition, in playing the piano, in children and in education, and now television production. So amazingly, all of these things could kind of come together in one thing: his own television show. So he finishes school and he gets married to Joanne, who he remained married to his whole life. She came from rural Alabama, was quite poor, so the kind of wealthy northern lifestyle was quite different for Joanne. But she said she loved being married to him, and he was a wonderful husband. They get married, they move to New York, he works for NBC, he's learning kind of the business. But ultimately they move back to Western Pennsylvania to be close to family, and he gets his first TV show. This is on the set of The Children's Corner, which was his first show. And while he's doing this television show, he enrolls at a local seminary, Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, and he starts taking classes. He wants to prepare for ministry. That's still part of his future. He's producing the show. He's writing scripts, writing songs, looking for segments. He's a new father and a theological student. So there's a lot going on, and he ultimately pulls the plug on the children's corner because he wants to finish up his studies. But he also has some pretty strong conflict with his partner here in the show. And it shows, again, sort of things that mattered to Fred Rogers and why they matter. She wanted to franchise the show. It was quite a successful show, and she wanted it to grow, which meant there would need to be advertisers. And Fred was fiercely and adamantly opposed to advertising to children. Rogers has King says this, Rogers believed it was immoral to present ads to little children who were most likely not capable of distinguishing between a program and the commercial that was selling them something. Rogers had no problem marketing to adults. His problem was with children. He didn't want to make or perpetuate children just being consumers, thoughtless consumers. So he pulled the plug on the show, finishes most of his education. He does a short stint in Canada, working for the CBC. And then he comes back and he'll start Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But it was during his time in seminary that his professors sent him to the University of Pittsburgh. And he met and then studied under the person who was the most influential in his life, a woman named Margaret McFarland. She was a prominent psychologist as well as professor of child development. And Rogers would meet with her weekly to go over scripts, ideas, new songs, everything. And Rogers would credit her for much of the shape and the nature of the work. They became good friends, and she was actually the chief psychological consultant on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which I think just speaks to the caliber of the show. It's a kid's show with a chief psychological consultant. That just blew me away. And she did so until her death in 1988. And Margaret helped Fred get back in touch with some of those childhood memories, like the memory of being chased and called Fat Freddy. And she always helped him anchor scripts and songs and even the set of Mr. Rogers in child development theory. And one of McFarland's mantras, one of the things she said a lot, which Rogers imbibed and translated into the show, was that anything human is mentionable and anything mentionable is manageable. This became a guiding and central principle for Rogers' life and work. Anything human is mentionable and anything mentionable is manageable. Rogers and McFarland believed it was imperative to help children, to enable children to name what they're feeling, what they're going through, in large part because they have no control over their surroundings. They're often powerless. They're responding to things outside of themselves. And name those things so that instead of being controlled by them, they can direct them and choose how they're going to act so their behavior isn't determined by what they feel. A lot of adults, I think, could also use some lessons in this, myself included. And Rogers would call this the good feeling of control, which I think is very similar to what the Apostle Paul meant by self-control, one of the fruits of the Spirit. And this, of course, ideally happens in a stable and loving home where a child can learn to explore these things with their parents, with people whom they love and whom love them back. That's not often the case, or not always the case. So Rogers wanted his show to be a place that would do that. So, again, so this is what he's learned in seminary. He does a short stint in Toronto, 6 years. I guess it's not that short of a stint. He comes back and begins Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And at this point, Fred is about 40, and he's busy getting things going on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But in the country is preparing for the presidency of Richard Nixon. And Nixon is clear from the get-go. He wants to cut funding to public television. He wants all it cut. We've heard other similar threats from other politicians that are sort of downstream from Richard Nixon. And so Nixon arranges a series of congressional hearings on the matter. And he strategically places this tough Italian-American, no-nonsense senator from Rhode Island, John Pastore, to oversee these things. Because he's confident Pastore will not let this happen. And the money will be cut, which means Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood will kind of sink even really before it starts. And so after a few days of testimony, it's Mr. Rogers' turn to speak to Pastore. And it's a bit of a longer clip. It's 6 minutes and 50 seconds. Chris, would you mind dimming the lights? But I want to play it for you in its entirety because I think it shows something of Rogers, and it's wonderful.
Hey, Rogers, you got the floor. Yeah.
Yeah. Senator Pastore. This is a philosophical statement and would take about 10 minutes to read, so I'll not do that. One of the first things that a child learns in a healthy family is trust. And I trust what you have said that you will read this. It's very important to me. I care deeply about children. My first children...
Will it make you happy if you read it?
I'd just like to talk about it, if it's all right.
Okay.
My first children's program was on WQED 15 years ago, and its budget was $30. Now, with the help of the Sears Roebuck Foundation and National Educational Television, as well as all of the affiliated stations, each station pays to show our program. It's a unique kind of funding in educational television. With this help, now our program has a budget of $6,000.
Wow.
It may sound like quite a difference, but $6,000 pays for less than 2 minutes of cartoons. 2 minutes of animated, what I sometimes say, bombardment. I'm very much concerned, as I know you are, about what's being delivered to our children in this country. And I've worked in the field of child development for 6 years now, trying to understand the inner needs of children. We deal with such things as the inner drama of childhood. We don't have to bop somebody over the head to make him... To make drama on the screen. We deal with such things as getting a haircut or the feelings about brothers and sisters and the kind of anger that arises in simple family situations. And we speak to it constructively.
How long a program is it?
It's a half hour every day. Most channels schedule it in the noontime as well as in the evening. WETA here has scheduled it in the late afternoon.
Could we get a copy of this so that we can see it? And maybe not today, but I'd like to see the program.
I'd like very much for you
I'd
to
like
see
to see the program itself, or any one of them, you see.
We made 100 programs for EEN, the Eastern Educational Network, and then when the money ran out, people in Boston and Pittsburgh and Chicago all came to the fore and said, we've got to have more of this neighborhood expression of care. And this is what I give. I give an expression of care every day to each child to help him realize that he is unique. I end the program by saying, you've made this day a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are. And I feel that if we in public television can only make it clear that feelings are mentionable and manageable, we will have done a great service for mental health. I think that it's much more dramatic that two men could be working out their feelings of anger. Much more dramatic than showing something of gunfire. I'm constantly concerned about what our children are seeing. And for 15 years I have tried in this country and Canada to present what I feel is a meaningful expression of care.
Do you narrate it?
I'm the host. Yes, and I do all the puppets, and I write all the music, and I write all the scripts.
Well, I'm supposed to be a pretty tough guy, and this is the first time I've had goosebumps for the last 2 days.
Well, I'm grateful, not only for your goosebumps, but for your interest in communication. Could I tell you the words of one of the songs which I feel is very important?
Yes.
This has to do with that good feeling of control, which I feel that children need to know is there. And it starts out, what do you do with the mad that you feel? And that first line came straight from a child. I work with children, doing puppets in very personal communication with small groups. What do you do with the mad that you feel? When you feel so mad you could bite. When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong, and nothing you do seems very right. What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag or see how fast you go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong and be able to do something else instead and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop, stop, stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a lady, and a boy can be someday a man.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. Looks like you just earned the $20 million.
So,
so almost 34 years after that day, at Mr. Rogers' memorial, after he died, almost 34 years to the day, a friend of Mr. Rogers, and someone who had a lot of correspondence with her, Amy Hollingsworth, writes in her book that they played that clip. They played that clip at his memorial service. And she said, in the same way that people there erupted spontaneously in applause and cheers, people did as well at the memorial. And she says this, "We weren't applauding a simple David and Goliath victory, although most people enjoy seeing the underdog triumph over the giant. Instead, we were rejoicing in the collective realization that the only thing better than a conquest is a conversion," which I think is a wonderful way to describe. There's a lot going on there, and you probably picked up on the influence of McFarland. Feelings are mentionable and manageable. The good feeling of control, being able to name and direct our feelings. And sometimes Mr. Rogers is sort of associated with feel-good, psychobabble, self-esteem-driven kind of stuff, but it's not the case. It's not the way that he presents himself here really at all. I sometimes have talked with students about how suppressing our feelings as a way to deal with our feelings is like trying to hold a beach ball down underwater. You can do it for so long, but eventually it just pops up somewhere, and it pops up in a place that you don't want it to pop up or come out. And so Rogers was convinced that all of us, especially children, were in deep need of help when it came to processing and directing our feelings, knowing that they're not just mentionable, but manageable. We are not at their mercy. And so we'll move on. We're going to move on to the second section. There are many ways to say I love you. We're going to look more at an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And we're going to hopefully be able to play this song.
It's all different friends and thinking about many different ways of saying I love you.
Saying is one of my ways of saying I love you.
Oh, I know that. Do you have time to give a song to my friend and me?
I sure do. There are many ways to say I love you. There are many ways to say I care about you. Many ways to say I love you. There's the singing way to say I love you. There's the singing something someone really likes to hear.
say I love you. Hanging up your coat before you're asked to do it. Drawing special pictures for the holidays. And making plays.
You'll find many ways to say I love you. You'll find many ways to understand what love is. Many ways.
Francois.
Oh, thank you, Fred. I like being a human being right here and now. Well, I guess I'm gonna have to get back to work.
I always like it whenever you have time to visit with us. Can I help you here?
Thank you.
I was just talking.
Something happened.
So. Back to, there are many ways to say I love you. This was a song that was sung again, like the previous song, over 40 times throughout the years of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And as the show progressed, it took off. 31 seasons in total at its height. 10% of all American homes with small children were watching daily. But there was close to nothing on the show that was incidental. Every aspect of the show had some sort of basis in the psychology of child development and was crafted with the intention of expressing not just, I want to entertain you, or I want to teach you something, or I want to babysit you while your parents do the dishes, or something else. They were all crafted in a way to say, I love you. And if you haven't seen any episodes of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood at all, if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, there's 6 seasons there. So you can thank Jeff Bezos. He's done a few good things for humanity, I suppose. But they're there. It's interesting. I have an almost 9-year-old and then a 4.5-year-old. My 9-year-old does not connect with it at all. My 4.5-year-old loves it. But this is a picture of the set. There's a very predictable, ritualistic feel to the show that to a 9-year-old comes across as boring. But it was intentional. At least to my almost 9-year-old, it comes across as boring. The camera almost always starts here on a flashing yellow light, signaling something about the nature of the show, that it's time to slow down. We're still going to have fun, we're going to imagine, we're going to learn, we're going to meet people, but there's no rush. There's going to be no kind of quick camera cuts, no explosions, no unexpected noises. Rogers believed that there were too few proponents of slowing down in our world, especially on TV. And he also worried that children were being too hurried in all areas of their lives. School schedules may follow a fixed schedule, he once noted, but human development does not. And so he wanted the neighborhood to move at a slower pace. And there's all sorts of studies on children who watched Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And one of them, entitled Aggressive and Pro-Social Television Programs and the Natural Behavior of Preschool Children, concluded or said that regular viewing of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood led to an increase in what they called a tolerance of delay, meaning that children in the study who watched the program regularly were more likely to be patient when they needed to wait for things, whether food that was coming or toys or the attention of one of their parents. And Lynn Frederick Kofer, a professor of psychology, writes that in other studies of children who watched the neighborhood, these children showed an increased persistence, greater ability to carry out responsibility without adult intervention in tasks like cleaning up, as well as increased cooperation, ability to express feelings and sympathy and help for others. Now, there's most likely all sorts of other contributing factors in these children's development and behavior than just Mr. Rogers. But it is one contributing factor, and I'm sure Rogers was very pleased to hear those things. But after the flashing yellow light, the camera pans across the living room to the front door. And in walks Mr. Rogers, singing, "It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. It's a beautiful day for a neighbor. Won't you be mine? Would you be mine?" And he heads to the closet and he trades his blazer for one of his classic homemade hand-knit cardigans. So if you don't know much about Mr. Rogers, you should know he has lots and lots of different color cardigans that were initially made by his mom. So he changes into a cardigan. He changes out of his dress shoes into sneakers to sort of be at home and to have a different feel. And he speaks. This is just on repeat. I can do that. There you go. If you behave better, I'll put it back. But he always talks directly to the camera. He'll often have something in his hands, whether a picture or blocks or some sort of toy, and he'll speak to the camera. He'll speak to his television neighbors. And I've witnessed firsthand, he'll ask questions or he'll talk about doing stretches, and my daughter will answer the questions or do the stretches with him. And from there, often they're visited by someone from the neighborhood. Someone comes into the living room here and shows Mr. Rogers something, or they go into the front yard, and they're visited by all sorts of people, like a gymnastics teacher, a breakdance instructor, a balloon artist, all sorts of people doing all sorts of things. Or maybe you're going to go on a trip with Mr. Rogers to see someone in the neighborhood. Sometimes you'll go see Yo-Yo Ma, who was a friend of Mr. Rogers' play. Sometimes you'll go to a shoe store, where you'll find a shoe that you really like, but they won't have it in your size. So you learn both how to go to a shoe store and also how to deal with the disappointment, like not having a shoe that's in your size. You'll go to a factory where they make toys. You might go to the Broadway production of Stomp, which was fun. You might go to a local farm, which in 1992, Rogers went to a local farm and introduced kids to kale. Kale is huge right now. It's 2019, but Rogers was way ahead. He was seeing down clearly that people are going to go nuts for kale. Or even go visit a steel drum maker. That was one of Lily's favorite things to see. But you go visit people. You go do something in the real world, or they come and visit. And then after this, you can see over here, there's a trolley on a little track. And this trolley that's here, the neighborhood trolley, the camera zooms in on the trolley, and the trolley takes you to the land of make-believe. And there's a very clear transition between Mr. Rogers' living room, his house, as well, and then entering the land of make-believe. That's part of the set of the land of make-believe right there. And there's more of the set. It was a set that was made in the 60s and was never really updated. He didn't see the need to. And it was filled with puppets. Here's Mr. Rogers with some of the puppets that were there. He voiced many of the puppets, but he never showed up in the land of make-believe. He never wanted to be there. Clear and defined boundaries were vital to Mr. Rogers. He did not want kids to be confused as to when it's time to imagine and make believe and when it's real life. And so he voiced the puppets, but he never showed up there. And when Big Bird wanted to come on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the deal was that the man who's inside, who's wearing the costume, I hope I didn't spoil anybody's evening, Big Bird is not, there's a person in there. If he was going to be in Mr. Rogers' living room, he had to take the costume off. And he refused to do it, so he only appeared in the land of make-believe. But the trolley leads you into the land of make-believe, and then it leads you out. There are clear transitions back to reality. And we'll be back in the living room, and Mr. Rogers will be there, waiting for you, and he's going to talk through whatever happened in the land of make-believe. Sometimes it was just silliness, but sometimes there was very important lessons for children in make-believe, such as how do you deal with a bossy friend? How do you manage your angry feelings? How do you learn ways to calm down when you're really excited? And why it's important to share the things you have, but if there's something that's extra special to you, you actually don't need to share that. You can hold on to that. So he talks through whatever has gone on in make believe, in the land of make believe. Ever an advocate for dealing with reality, the land of make believe also taught about matters that were difficult for grown-ups as well. So in the land of make believe, and then in Mr. Rogers' home, he spoke to children about things like death, war, assassinations, divorce. Almost nothing from the real world which affected the lives of children was off limits for Rogers. For example, when Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated, Rogers saw his role in the larger culture as twofold. One, to remind parents to involve their children in the grieving process, but then two, also to help children grieve through and understand something as difficult as an assassination. Rogers was fiercely committed to stick to reality, no matter how challenging or difficult it was. And so, but commenting on the land of make-believe in these transitions, Roger says, I feel that in the opening reality of the program, we deal with the stuff that dreams are made of. And then in the neighborhood of make-believe, we deal with it as if it were a dream. Anything can happen in make-believe. We then talk about anything back in reality. Margaret used to always say, whatever is mentionable is manageable. So at this point in the show, after he talks, he always feeds his fish. He always feeds his fish. He changes back into his blazer. He goes back to the cupboard, changes back into his blazer, changes out of his sneakers, and he sings a song called It's a Good Feeling. It's a good feeling to know you're alive. And he says goodbye until next time and walks out the front door. And if it's a weekday episode, he says, I'll see you when the day is new. But if it's a Friday episode, he says, I'll see you when the week is new. He didn't even want to confuse kids that maybe give them the wrong expectation that he was going to be there tomorrow. So there is this ritualistic, formulaic tenor of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. This is just a lovely picture of him with some school kids. It was familiar and it was predictable because it was intended to convey a sense of permanence and that permanent things could be depended upon. Amy Hollingsworth, again, comments about studies that have shown children from lower-income homes, who often have to deal with higher levels of inconsistency in their lives, showed greater positive impact from Mr. Rogers' neighborhoods than from their non-poor peers. So his avoidance of flashy updates to his wardrobe, to his set, to his routine, Rogers was choosing to convey care and dependability. It was one of the many ways he learned to say, I love you. Now, Fred's own personal life and spiritual life actually mirrored this predictability and routine. He was a highly, highly disciplined guy. He woke every day at 5 for prayer and for time studying the Bible. His biographer, Maxwell King, who I said often doesn't get his spirituality, does write this, which I think is helpful. He said Fred would visualize whoever he would be seeing that day in his time of prayer, so that he could be prepared to be as caring and as giving as he could be when he actually encountered them later in the day. So he spends that time alone in the morning. By 7:30, he always was in the pool, the local pool where he swam at least a mile every day, and then he weighed himself in every single day. And every day, he weighed 143 pounds. This is where there's an eccentricity about Mr. Rogers, because even his weight has some significance. In Rogers' numerology, 143 stands for I love you. He was very serious about this. I think there's so many of us who look at the scales and what we see is not I love you, but things that promote self-hate. But he was convinced that if he was going to express and share the love of God, he needed to build into his life and even into his very body ways that could remind himself that he is loved by God and he has love to share with others. And each morning before he dove into the pool, he would sing, this is again quirky, he would sing out loud to himself in his locker, not too loud, Jubilate Deo, a song that his friend Henry Nouwen had taught him, that they both learned at the Taze community in France. And this rhythm and routine were so important to Fred. Again, he believed that love was something that must be developed. It takes choice. It takes deliberateness. It takes space and time and attention to grow in us if it's going to move through us. And Fred remained that television was the means that he could have the love of God move through him. He said, "I'm convinced that the space between the television set and the viewer is holy ground." This led to a fascinating phenomenon. Fred was a stickler. Mr. Rogers was a stickler about everything on the show. Everything was under his, he had the final say. The cast and co-workers were not allowed to utter a word of improv or even have a slight change to their tone of voice if he didn't approve of it. And everyone had to stick to the scripts that he wrote with Margaret or had reviewed with Margaret McFarland. But he was also a firm believer in this holy ground between him and the viewers, and he called it a space that was ripe for the adaptation of the Holy Spirit. That's what he called it, the adaptation of the Holy Spirit. And he said countless times over his years, someone would come up to him and say, "Do you remember that episode where you did this and this and then you said this?" And he would go back into his scripts and he would say, I never said those things. But he said, amazingly, people would hear what they needed to hear from the show. And he called this the adaptation of the Holy Spirit. And he said, he thought to himself, well, happily, you got the words that you needed at that moment. And so what we put on the television can, by the Holy Spirit, be translated into what this person needs to hear and see. And without that translation, it's all dross, as far as I'm concerned. And this was also an answer to Fred's daily prayer that he prayed as he walked through the studio doors every day. He said, "Dear God, let some word that is heard be yours." So these are all ways that Fred wanted to say, "I love you," to convey care, a neighborhood expression of care, as he calls it. Now, if we back up the clip we watched a minute ago, where they sang the song, "There is many ways to say I love you," is significant in other in ways too. This man sharing the pool with Fred and singing with him is Francois Clemens, who had for many years played Officer Clemens on the show, one of the recurring characters. This was filmed in 1993, and at this point it had been nearly a decade since Francois Clemens had been on the show. He'd been off doing other things. He's a professional opera and gospel singer. But this was his last appearance on the show. He shows up later and they sing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot together. And it's clearly meant to be an echo. It's clearly meant to be a recreation of one of Francois' earliest appearances on the show and one of the most memorable and countercultural ways that Fred Rogers said, "I love you." Now, Clemens was born in the Deep South. He was a descendant of slaves and sharecroppers, but he grew up in a tough neighborhood, Youngstown, Ohio. And he began a career as an opera singer, and he was touring when Rogers met him. He was singing in Mr. Rogers' church. And Rogers invited Clemens to come on the show and play a character, to appear in the neighborhood as, all of all things, a police officer. Mm-hmm. Clemens recounts that Fred said, "I have this idea you could be a police officer. That kind of stopped me in my tracks. I grew up in the ghetto. I did not have a positive opinion of police officers. Policemen were sicking police dogs and sending water hoses on people. And I really had a hard time putting myself in that role. So I was not excited about being Officer Clemens at all." But soon enough, Fred convinced him, and he joined the cast of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in 1968, August of 1968. Which is 4 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. In doing so, Clemens became the first African-American with a regular role on a daytime television series. But as bold of a move of love as that was, Rogers decided to press in even further. So not long after Clemens' debut, the standard routine that we've been familiar with of Rogers coming in, it's a beautiful day, blazer, puts on his, the cardigan. The standard routine is altered, which immediately is sending signs something is different, something important is going on. And instead of putting on the cardigan, Rogers lets us know that it is extremely hot in the neighborhood today. And he wants to put his feet in a pool of cold water. And he moves to his front yard where he starts filling a small plastic pool with water. And he begins to soak his feet. And then, if I could do it.
All life long. Oh, there's Officer Clemens. Hi, Officer Clemens. Come in.
Roger, how are you?
Fine. Won't you sit down?
Oh, sure. Just for a moment.
It's so warm. I was just putting some water on my feet.
Oh, it sure is.
Would you like to join me?
It looks awfully enjoyable, but I don't have a towel or anything.
Oh, you share mine.
Okay, sure.
Oh, oh, hey, I'll put some more water in here.
Oh. This is going to turn into a beautiful day.
You like bare feet?
Well, yeah, as I grew older, I liked it more and more.
Uh-huh. Good for you. You're pulling up your pants. I forgot to do that at first.
I don't want them to get wet.
Right.
That feels great.
Right here.
You know, when you're a policeman, you do an awful lot of walking. And sometimes your feet get tired.
Right.
That feels better already.
Good.
Just massage them a little bit.
Cool water on a hot day.
Well, thank you for your refreshment!
Oh, I'm glad you like it.
You're welcome, Officer Clemens.
Mm-hmm. Is that enough?
Oh, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Well, that was so enjoyable. I'm sorry I couldn't stay longer.
Well, I know how busy you are. But sometimes just a minute like this will really make a difference.
There, that was dark. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Who can put your hand in my hand and be ready to feel safe and strong? You're a child, so you can do it. Children do. There we are.
You have great boots to fill, Officer Simon.
Well, thank you very much. Well.
Thanks for stopping by.
So long.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
But today, this small gesture might not seem like that much, what we just saw. But in 1969, what Fred orchestrated was considerable. And if you saw his face when he looks up at the camera, totally, totally deliberate. He knows exactly what he's doing. We're almost there. Hold on. Hannah Anderson, commenting on this scene, writes that across the country, public fountains, public transportation, public schools, and public pools at this moment have become a battleground of racial segregation. Under Jim Crow era policy, not only could black Americans and white Americans not swim at the same time, many pools were entirely off limits to black Americans. This was fueled by a fear that African Americans carried disease and the view that swimming pools were intimate contexts. So like the lunch counter and public buses, swimming pools had become a point of protest. Both black and white protesters staged wade-ins and swim-ins at beaches and community pools. But just like at sit-ins, local authorities often responded with arrest and sometimes physical violence. In his book, The Peaceful Neighbor, Discovering the Countercultural Mr. Rogers, Michael Long points out that Fred's work for the greater good did not take the form of marching, rallying, or picketing. Hi, Lily. He might have occasionally written a note to a member of Congress, and of course he testified before the Senate subcommittee, but more often Fred did his work in and through his own context. Fred didn't march against Jim Crow, but he did cast black American actors on his program, and he always featured Latino, Asian American, and black American children on his show alongside Caucasian children. He didn't travel to Birmingham or Selma in support of integration, but he set up a pool in his neighborhood and invited Officer Clemens to soak his feet and share his towel. There's much work to be done in regards to race in America. Perhaps we haven't progressed as far from the 1960s as we would like to have thought we would have. Marching, protesting, writing, calling our representatives, and organizing are all good ways to make change. But as Shea Tuttle, an author who's putting a book out later this fall on the faith of Mr. Rogers, writes, Fred's life reminds us that we can work for the well-being of the most vulnerable wherever they may be in whatever work we do. In other words, there are many ways to say I love you. And there's doubtlessly another level of significance to this, knowing Fred's Christian faith. For those familiar with the life of Jesus and his humble act of washing the feet of his disciples, the image of the set of white feet and black feet in a pool perhaps also map a possible course for racial justice and reconciliation in our country, one not just of policy, but of friendship and of service, where those who have power are served, those who have little power are served by and befriended those who do. Now, of all the ways to say I love you, sometimes the best way is just to say so, something which is surprisingly harder than it might sound. And so we're going to watch another clip and hear a classic from Mr. Rogers, It's You I Like, a song that was sung 63 times throughout the years. And the time we're going to watch it is the most memorable of those 63. It features Mr. Rogers and a young boy, young quadriplegic boy named Jeff Erlinger. And I'm going to play it for you, if for no other reason than it's a rare moment of unscripted Mr. Rogers neighborhood. So what you hear Jeff say is just Jeff. There was no script for him to follow. But also because Mr. Rogers called this his most treasured moment of all his years of doing the show. And I'm just going to read the words. It's you I like. It's not the things you wear. It's not the way you do your hair. But it's you I like. The way you are right now. The way down deep inside you. Not the things that hide you. Not your toys. They're just beside you. But it's you I like, every part of you. Your skin, your eyes, your feelings, whether old or new. I hope that you'll remember, even when you're feeling blue, that it's you I like, it's you yourself, it's you. It's you I like. And the story behind what we're going to see is that this is from 1981, and Jeff and Mr. Rogers had met about 5 years prior when Jeff was four or five, and was about to have a major surgery. And his parents said, you can do anything. We'll do anything before your surgery. What do you want to do? And they were expecting to go to Disney World. But instead, he said, I want to meet Mr. Rogers. And so within a few weeks, they were able to arrange a meeting with Mr. Rogers, and they had breakfast. And they thought that was a lovely thing, but that was most likely the end. But 5 years later, Mr. Rogers was doing a whole week of episodes on mechanics, on things that were electric. And he thought of Jeff and insisted that Jeff would be back on with his wheelchair. And we'll see in the same manner that he would ask a young kid about their favorite toy or ice cream, Mr. Rogers asked Jeff to explain his wheelchair, and then they sing this song together, It's You I Like.
I think I know who that is.
Mr. Rogers?
Hey, Jeff. I'm glad to see you. Thank you very much for coming by. I asked Jeff, this is my friend Jeff Erlinger. He's one of my neighbors here. And I asked him if he would come by today because I wanted you to meet him.
And I wanted you to see his electric wheelchair. We've been talking about electric cars and all kinds of things we've been thinking about this week. Would you show me how you make your chair go?
Okay, sure. All right. Well, first, this is the reverse way. Mm-hmm. I move it up to turn it on.
Okay.
And
take a long time to learn how?
No, not really. I got the wheelchair, and I only took, I first got the wheelchair, it only took me about a day to learn how to use it.
Gee, that's wonderful. Jeff, your mom and dad must be really proud of you.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah. Well, I know. Now, can you tell my friends what it is that made you need this wheelchair?
Sure. Well, when I was about 7 months old, I had a tumor, and I broke the nerves to tell my hands and legs what to do.
I see.
And they tried to cut the tumor, but they couldn't get it, and I became handicapped. And I got a wheelchair when I was 4 years old.
That was your first one?
Mm-hmm.
When you were four?
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, sort of.
You must have some mighty good doctors who've been taking care of you.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me any of your doctor's name?
Yeah, I have a pediatrician, Dr. Hansen, who works in Madison, St. Mary's Hospital, and then at UW, the bone doctor is Dr. Green, who takes care of the bones, I guess, because he's a bone doctor. Anyway, I had surgery earlier this summer because I have pain in my stomach called autonomic dysreflexia, and I just...
What was that?
Autonomic dysreflexia.
Wow.
I'm not exactly sure what it means.
You sure can say it.
Yeah. I had a surgery done just recently to try and cut the sphincter because it's holding my urine in. So, well, you have a lot of things going on in here. It just shows you have a lot of things happening to you when you're handicapped, but most of the time.
And
sometimes it happens when you're not handicapped.
Of course. But you're able to talk about those things so well and help other people who might have the same kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that song that I sometimes sing called It's You I Like?
Uh-huh.
I'd like to sing that to you and with you.
Okay, sure.
It's you I like. It's not the things you wear. It's not the way you do your hair. But it's you I like. The way you are right now. The way down deep inside you. Not the things that you
hide.
Not your fancy chair. That's just beside you. But it's you I like. Every part of you. Your skin, your eyes, your feeling. Whether old or new. I hope that you remember. Even when feeling blue, that it's you I like, it's you yourself,
It's you. It's you.
And there must be times when you do feel blue.
Uh-huh.
What do you do during those times?
Well, it depends.
Sometimes do you make up stories?
Yeah.
Or read?
Yeah.
Or play? I know that's the way I did when I was a little boy. Had all kinds of things that
did
I would
do. Did it help?
It did help. Yeah. Does it help you?
Yeah.
We have to all discover our own ways, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Of doing things when we're feeling blue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not feeling blue right now, though.
Me neither.
I'm so glad that you came today.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I hope you'll come back to visit again.
Okay.
Will you?
Yeah.
And will you give your mom and dad my best?
Sure.
Because they are sure great people.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye-bye, Jeff. I'll watch you as you go. It is. I think I know who that is.
Mr. Rogers?
So the hero here is Jeff. Jeff is the brave one whose life is difficult and will continue to be so. But he's not just meant to be pitied. In this moment, in this neighborhood, Jeff is honored. Not just as a young quadriplegic boy, which is part of his difficult reality, and not to be skirted around, but as someone who bears the image of God and deserves respect and dignity. In Mr. Rogers' office for decades, there was a framed quote from the book The Little Prince. What is essential is invisible to the eye. This was a daily reminder to Rogers that all the people he met, were made in God's image and deserved respect, including Jeff. And so, Rogers, this is my favorite picture of him with this little boy. Rogers was an eccentric man. In a lot of ways, I mean, beyond the 143 pounds thing. And there are countless stories, though, about how he didn't just play a wise, gentle, loving neighbor on TV, but he was one in real life as well. Jessica Reeves, a former real-life neighbor of Rogers, as well as a Time magazine reporter, said that Rogers not only greeted children on Halloween and talked to them enthusiastically about their costume, his house was well known on the block as the house that would give out the much coveted full-size candy bars. And when Roger's assistant of 33 years, Hedda Shaparapan, had to put her cat down, Rogers took the afternoon off work to make sure she didn't have to go do it alone. Those to me are two instances of human excellence. And Rogers wasn't perfect. He was a workaholic. He didn't know how to stop. He didn't know how to take a vacation. And his own children, sadly, often felt the brunt of his absence. Even as teenagers, for example, they actually started a pot grow-up in the basement of the Rogers house. So could you imagine getting pot grown in Mr. Rogers' basement? That's anyway. But for someone so able to connect with children, sometimes you do get the impression from his own children that as they went through adolescence, he wasn't really sure what to do with them or how to connect with them. But that being said, to this day, if you look online, you're going to find all sorts of crazy stories that he was a sniper in the Navy SEALs, that he's covered in tattoos, and that he spent all his time in prison. But there are no credible accounts of him doing any of these sorts of things, of laundering money, throwing tantrums on set, demanding high-end goods backstage, cheating on his wife, or being involved in some other scandal. From all accounts that I could find, and there were a lot, Fred Rogers didn't live a perfect life, but he did live one of deep integrity to the principles and truths he believed in. And he modeled something for us, something that's accessible to us. And for someone who was so wealthy and came from wealth, he lived a simple life. He drove a light blue Honda Accord. He abstained from meat because he said he couldn't eat anything that had a mother. And he never drank. He never drank alcohol. He regularly wore old khakis and well-worn jackets. Mr. Rogers, though, was diagnosed with stomach cancer, which took his life within a year of his diagnosis, on February 27th, 2003. And he died in his own bed, in his own apartment, in his beloved Pittsburgh. And in the days immediately following his death, his real-life friends and his neighbors began receiving presents from him at their homes. A pair of cufflinks, some cherished photographs, a set of golf clubs, a check for a new car. Knowing that his own death was imminent, Fred had arranged to mail out in advance gifts along with personal correspondence of his deep affection and gratitude to let his friends know that he loved them. Normal LaBrie lectures end with, we'll stop and we'll take some time for question and answer. But the way Mr. Rogers chose to end his public addresses, which he hated doing, he did not like doing public addresses, was something slightly different. And so I'm just going to read from how he did this, from the night he was inducted into the TV Hall of Fame, which if you want a good couple minutes on YouTube, you should look this up, because Jeff Erlinger, 25 years later, is the one who introduces him and inducts him. It's amazing because he wheels out on stage, and before he can even get to the mic to speak about how significant and wonderful Rogers is, Rogers, as a 70-plus-year-old man, has leaped out of his seat and jumped onto stage to see Jeff. And he's so excited to see Jeff. It's really beautiful. But he says this. He says, "Our part," and he's speaking to his fellow sort of creators. Yeah, thank you. Or TV personalities. He says, "Our vocation is to show what the good in life is all about. But how do we make goodness attractive? In part by doing whatever we can to bring courage to the lives of those who move near our own. By treating our neighbor at least as well as we treat ourselves, and allowing that to inform everything that we produce. Who in your life has been such a servant to you? Who has helped you love the good that grows within you? Let's take 1 minute together to think quietly about those who have loved us and wanted what was best for us in life, who have encouraged us to become who we are tonight. So we'll take 1 minute of silence. I'll watch the time." So no matter where they are, either here or in heaven, imagine how pleased those people must be to know that you thought of them right now. And if anyone, before we move into question and answer, is willing to say who they thought of, who came to mind, you can take a moment to do that and then move into question and answer. The documentary that I said ends by doing this as well. It's quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm. my third grade teacher, Mr. Ellis.
I thought of my father's friend, Fred Palma.
Thought of my youth pastor, Steve.
We can move into a time of questions or response or, anything that struck you. Or there was a lot more to say about Mr. Rogers' life, but you're also free to go if you need to. I took a fair bit of your time, so thank you for your patience. But,
thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Christian communities all over the world where people with physical and cognitive disabilities live alongside typically developing people. He passed away last week, and I just read a couple articles about his life, and he's Catholic, he's a Catholic. And but anyway, they shared at some point in his life, someone asked him about the possibility of being sainted in the Catholic Church. And his response to that was that he had no interest in being sainted, because he didn't want people to think that what he had done, the work that he had done through L'Arche, was because there was something special about him. He's like, anybody can do this. Mm-hmm. And I don't want sainthood, because I don't want people to think there's something special about me, mm-hmm. and that this type of thing is unattainable, and you just have to be a special person to be able to do it. And I was just thinking about that. Anyway, I was just really struck by that.
Yep.
And I read that in an article and reading about very similar thing that you shared, that Mr. Rogers said about himself and the way he viewed his own work and what he did. Mm-hmm. I think it's significant and so countercultural.
Sarah?
Do you have to know which Yubilate Deo he was singing on the show? Do you know how to find books?
I could look, and it's mentioned in both books. I could look, but it's just one from Teze, so I don't know if they have multiple settings of it or, So
where do you just go to YouTube to watch? I mean, if we wanted to watch some of the episodes.
Yeah, some of the episodes. So some of the episodes you can. The Amazon Prime is a great place to start.
Okay.
Legally, some of the clips we saw, I think, have been sort of, I'm not sure whoever owns the copyrights know they exist on Vimeo, but you can actually watch almost every episode of Mr. Rogers on Vimeo. Amazon Prime just has six seasons, but, and then, yeah, if you just, I mean, YouTube is an endless pit of garbage, but it will bring you to some pretty wonderful Mr. Rogers clips, so some highlights. But and that's actually the first time I've watched that one with Jeff Arlinger and not cried. I can't, it gets me. So, anyone else have any questions or any thoughts or anything? Yeah, Ben?
Intrigued by the term TV neighbors, because he's clearly, he's in the height of his career, he's speaking to millions of kids, but speaking as if it's face to face to a real next door neighbor, you, this individual that I like, and he's saying I like you to millions of kids that he's never met, and there seems to be, I was just thinking, the analogy of that, which seems really genuine, and I'm very hesitant to to criticize the reality of that.
Yeah.
To today, the kind of, you know, I'm friends with someone on Facebook, and we're such good friends, and I have 600,000 of them.
Yeah.
And it's just the level of unreality that sort of the internet has introduced, where I call virtual things real. What's the difference? I guess it's because there's something so beautiful and genuine about this term.
Yeah.
TV neighbor, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Any thoughts there?
Yeah, his name has just slipped my mind, but he is sort of one of the chief film reviewers for Entertainment Weekly, and he told a story. He was from Pittsburgh, and he was going through a fairly difficult season as a college student, and somehow walked into a room at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and Mr. Rogers was on, and I don't even remember what episode he said, but something about it really hit him. And he said it was, strangely enough, within a year he ran into Mr. Rogers, and he just said, "Hey, I know you don't know me, but you meant a lot to." They got in an elevator, and he said, "You don't know me, but you know, I was going through this tough season, and I saw this episode, and this thing happened." And Mr. Rogers' response was, "Oh, so you're one of my television neighbors." And he sort of said it full, like, no embarrassment to someone in their mid-20s who's kind of cool and edgy or, you know, angsty. And he said they got out of the elevator, and he sat down on a bench or something and said, would you like to sit down and tell me about that difficult season? And so they did. And so I think part of what's different about him was, I do think he saw it like as a vocation, in a sense. Like and when he meets them in person, there's stories about times to meet Mr. Rogers that local affiliates of PBS would have, and they prepare for 300 kids to come. Mm-hmm. And 5,000 kids would come. Mm-hmm. And he was like, "Well, we're going to stay until I get to, like, see these kids. Like, we're not going to cut it off." And even he really disliked giving out his autograph. He really didn't like to sign things. So he would carry a camera and take pictures with people and then ask for their address. And then he would have the film developed and send them a picture and a note. Sometimes he wrote the note, sometimes he just, like, dictated the note. And this book has some of the letters, and they're, this book by Maxwell King, some of them are just absolutely amazing. And one of the ones that I remember was a single mom who was living in a trailer park or some sort of tough place, and she was struggling to pay the bills and didn't have enough money for Christmas. So she, and her kids liked Mr. Rogers, so she wrote and asked him for a picture, signed pictures. So he sent the signed pictures, and he sent notes to the kids, and then he sent a note to her, and he said, "How proud your kids must be of you for you to think about them this way and care about them so much." And like, he took all of these moments to like acknowledge people. One of the other letters was from a father who wrote to him, and his son was super concerned because he said, it might even be worth just reading the letter. I've taken enough of your time with my, let's see if I can find it real quick. It's in the back. It's pretty wonderful. So this is the letter. "Dear Mr. Rogers, while putting my son to bed last night, he said, 'Mr. Rogers doesn't poop.' And I said, 'Then of course you did.' He denied it vehemently. I asked him where his certainty came from, and he said, 'Well, I've never seen him poop.' I pointed out that there were lots of people he hadn't seen poop, and they all still did. He accepted that others, adults and kids, but denied it about you. I kissed him goodnight and left the room. 5 minutes later, I was summoned to his bedside. 'Daddy, I know Mr. Rogers doesn't poop.' 'How?' I asked. 'Because I've seen his house. And he just has a closet, a living room, a kitchen, and a yard.' Sincerely, Isaac's father. So Fred Rogers wrote back, "Dear Isaac, your father told me you had an interesting talk with him about whether I poop. It's good that you and he were talking about that. I know it can be hard to understand that I do. I am a real person, and one thing for certain is that all real people poop. That is an important part of how our bodies work. Little by little, as you grow, you will learn more about how our bodies work. And it's good that you are thinking about that now. On some of our programs, I show the bathroom in my television house. It's off to the side of the kitchen. We don't often show the bathroom of our television set because it's not my real house. I think of it as my television house. That's the place where I stop by during my workday to have a television visit with my friends. When I'm at work, I use the bathrooms in the building where we make our programs." But it says this, "But Fred wasn't satisfied with just writing to Isaac. He also sent a letter to Isaac's father. He says this, 'Your letter was absolutely refreshing. Thank you for all that you shared with us, especially for the conversation you had with Isaac about bodily functions. That's such a wonderful story to attest to young children's focus on bathroom concerns. But what particularly struck me was the way you were so sensitive to your son's questions, and that you were willing to help him think the issues through, even with a subject that can be as sensitive as that. Your son is indeed fortunate to have a father like you." And it's just kind of person after person.
Yeah.
So Francois Clemens said that the first man who ever told him he loved him was Mr. Rogers. And he said, "My father never did, my stepfather never did, and I wanted to hear, like, I needed to hear that my whole life." And so there's just all these, so I think part of the thing was, I think he was aware of the art, in some sense, the artificiality of having millions of, but he also, it was very real for him when he met them, and every opportunity he could, I think, to bless and encourage and surprise people. And one of his things was, one of his mantras, other than, you know, whatever is human is mentionable, or whatever is human is mentionable, whatever is mentionable is manageable, is he said, "One of the greatest gifts you can give someone is to let them know that they are loved, but they are also capable of loving." And he constantly, in his, when he spoke, like, people who worked on the set, people who he wrote letters to, that second half, not just that you're loved, but you're capable of loving. Like, you have this in you. Acknowledging their dignity, acknowledging that, and he just, that was sort of, he saw people so differently, I think. And that's what I liked about, I don't totally love the language of, like, self-possession, but I do think that quote from his friend that Fred was the most powerful person he's ever met was because he could sort of see through stuff that didn't matter, I think, and get to, like, the heart of things. And and again, he wasn't perfect, but and it's really interesting. There's other, that's not the only documentary on him, and some of the other ones focus more on his relationship with the cast of characters that put the show on, the camera guys, the sound guys, and they're just, like, kind of rough. The actor Michael Keaton, I don't know if people know Michael Keaton, he got his first gig on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He just clearly, like, loved these people that were so different than him and never felt the need to kind of be cool or be hip or be edgy. He was just kind of himself. And this is another story, but they would play pranks on him. Like, one time, one of the sound guys, I think this is in the documentary, not the visual of this, but just really recounting of this, but he comes in saying it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, and he goes to the closet, and he opens the closet, and his cardigans aren't there, but one of the guys is there, like, completely naked. It just surprises him, and he, like, just rolls with it. And another guy on set, he was sort of rough around the edges. I think this is in the documentary, too. I can't remember. But Fred always took pictures. He was taking pictures of people all the time and sending them pictures. And so one day he stole the camera and mooned the camera, and they took a picture of this guy's butt, and then without Mr. Rogers knowing. And so he was waiting, you know, waiting to hear how is Mr. Rogers going to take, and like nothing came of it. And like months passed, and then for Christmas, he got this huge package from Mr. Rogers, and he opened it, and Mr. Rogers had the picture blown up to the poster size and gave it back to him for his... you get the impression that like if you were around him, he just tried to figure out ways to let you know he cared about you and sort of met you where you were. So I don't know if that totally answers that question, but yeah. And I do think he'd be terrified of the internet. I think he died before that happened, but I think he'd be frightened. And yeah, so. But anybody else have any thoughts or Mr. Rogers' stories? Or yeah, Marie.
I was really interested in his concern to distinguish reality from fantasy.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of something Mrs. Schaefer used to say about children's books and stories, and she would just make a very clear distinction. She said it's very important to read, you know, to read to your children, read all kinds of things to your children, but to really make clear, okay, this is a book, say if it's in a star fiction or something, this is the book that could have happened, but didn't.
Yeah.
Or this is a biography, this is a story of a real person who lived.
Yeah.
The Bible she would describe as a unique book, doesn't have mistakes in it, but then also she was a firm believer that children needed fantasy, but that you needed to explain it. And this is make believe, and it's so much fun to do make believe, and it's really important to make believe, but it's different. And in a way, it fits too. With, I mean, his passion about not having not showing ads to kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is so important, and that's today. Yeah. There's ads everywhere. There's ads.
Yeah, there's ads on the YouTube videos that you watch of him.
Even the TV shows are ads. Right?
Yeah. Mary Frances.
Yeah, I was just thinking about just a little bit. Ben's question made me think about this. That I was struck by what you shared. I can't remember the phrase, but that idea of like the space between the television and the computer, and
it's holy ground. Yeah.
Holy ground. The spirit's work, and I was just thinking of how we spent a lot of time, literally a lot of time, talking about the lordship of Christ over all parts of life, and the sacred secular divide, and trying to push back against that, you know, against the truth of that. But yet, I'm listening to you talk about this, and of course, like there's this part of me where I'm like, television's not holy ground. You know, like but TV's trashy. Like, you know, this internal thing, but yet he just that's what I was thinking of, this example of that cheesy little saying of like bloom where you're planted. But he was somebody who kind of was fascinated with television as a medium. He had a deep commitment and care for children, and so it was like, so this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And that idea of recognizing that, regardless of kind of what the MO is or how people feel, but you know, I mean, people didn't feel better than the same way they feel about it now.
Yeah.
They're recognizing like this is holy ground.
Yeah. And
Holy Spirit, this is not outside God's right, the place and the way that God can work.
And he didn't watch TV. He actually didn't like much of it. And that documentary that had the picture of "Won't You Be My Neighbor" shows very well his disdain for much children's television.
Yeah.
And he even struggled with sort of even Sesame Street, because he felt like Sesame Street was too much, too flashy, and also how they made product lines. He was very apprehensive about. The show being made, like marketing the show to sell toys.
Yeah.
But he sort of made peace with them when Big Bird came on. But he also felt as though children's television is all about cognitive development. Like I said, he wanted also relational and emotional development to be part of that as well, especially for small kids. And in the documentary, it shows well he... He actually took a season a bit. He stopped doing the neighborhood and tried to do shows for adults, which kind of floundered. It didn't work as well. But what brought partly what brought him back was stories of kids who put on capes and would jump out of windows thinking, I can fly, because the cape will help me fly. And he was fierce in that sense. He had very strong opinions, in ways that I might not completely go all the way there with him. I see what he's saying. But yeah, and he made an appearance on Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, where he played a pastor. But other than that, he didn't go on. He was invited. He did like Oprah and talk show, late night shows. There's some wonderful interactions of him on with David Letterman or Johnny Carson. And Johnny Carson made fun of him quite a bit, actually. Even his interaction with Eddie Murphy, who did Robinson's Neighborhood. But yeah, he'd watch that sort of thing, and like some of it he thought was in good taste, and he could laugh at himself. He thought Eddie Murphy's was really funny. But he evidently also, so he didn't watch much TV. He evidently really liked Monty Python's Flying Circus, but didn't watch that much. So it's just interesting that this is the medium he chose, and then as it developed and became, I mean, because, yeah, he's a senior in college, and it's his first time seeing a television. It's totally new. He's wealthy, so that's also why they have a television. I don't think he foresaw where it was, even by the time he was at his height in the 70s and 80s. But, yeah. Yeah, anyway. Yeah?
I had kind of a thought about what's sometimes called, like, faith films or different movies that are, you know, sort of quote-unquote Christian movies. Mm-hmm. And they don't always have the best reputation in some circles, mm-hmm. but also other circles love them. But I was kind of thinking that, like, Mr. Rogers kind of, like, this is very, it is entertainment that operates under a Christian, like, with a Christian ethic, but it doesn't, we don't necessarily know that it's doing that. Mm-hmm. We just see that what he's telling us grabs us, mm-hmm. and we can identify with it, and there's, like, this redemptive quality about it. And I'm just thinking it's kind of a good example of a believer just doing, not necessarily having to say his faith all the time, but just doing what he does really well. Mm-hmm. Just thinking kind
yeah.
of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there are, yeah, I mean, he definitely walked an interesting path as a Christian person. Yeah, I'd be curious what he would think of. I do get the sense with him it was like a calling, and from what I gather, besides that scene with Jeff and a couple other moments, it was like this is how it's going to be. It's my way or the highway. He was very difficult I think he was easy to be around, but I think he was difficult to work with. But yeah, he. And it flowed from his, it was undergirded by his understanding of how children develop. Mm-hmm. So psychology, but also very much informed by his faith, mm-hmm. and the dignity of children and the need to care for children, and to protect children. There's interviews with him where he talks quite openly about his faith, and, there's ways that he speaks. It's sort of like a commencement address or some other public thing where he's just quoting the Bible, but he's not telling you he's quoting the Bible. Which I think is quite an interesting thing. But I mean, theologically, I think he's probably more progressive or more than I am, you know, in a lot of things. But I do think, from all accounts, like, he was pretty devout, especially with the scriptures and praying, like, daily, and then praying throughout his day and always identified as a Christian. But so anyway, yeah. Those, I don't know if I'm just sort of responding to your comment, which, yeah, thank you. Anybody else? Anything? If not, thanks. Oh.
Ben's gone, but only thing I could think about with the comparison with him and his neighbor audience in television land, that was millions of people, and clearly they were his make-believe friends, but they were real people. And having 600,000 followers on Facebook on your account, like him having those neighbors was for them.
Hmm. Yeah.
He poured his life out.
Yeah.
For them. Whereas having, you know, however many K friends on Facebook, that's for that person.
Yeah. To get endorsement deals.
To get endorsement deals for the puffing up of their ego, for their influencer payments, all those things. It's for them. Whereas he had all these apparently make-believe friends who were real people.
Mm-hmm.
It was for them.
Yeah. And he'd be like, "Oh, you're one of my neighbors." Like, yeah, like let's talk. So
I see that.
Yeah, that's good.
I was kind of thinking that as well, because it's sort of like Mr. Rogers had sort of like activated neighbors or activated friends, and sometimes we can have more passive friendships, and I think that the idea of having 600,000 friends on Facebook is like, it's a great idea, possibly, as long as, like, to make it more like Mr. Rogers, we would have to be able to say, like, okay, if I meet someone and they say, I'm your friend, or if I meet anyone, like, this is a human, and I will wash their feet with my own towel, or, you know, share my lunch with them, or whatever it is, and it's sort of like, at some point, the Mr. Rogers neighborhood set had to, like, the lights had to be off and the doors had to be locked and everyone had gone home. I think sometimes that's what our neighborhoods are like.
Hmm.
But his neighborhood was like, he had the lights turned on and he was ready to mobilize at any time.
Hmm. Yeah. Huh. Well, if no one else has anything, I'm going to share one more story that is told multiple times in the Mr. Rogers secondary literature. But it's hard, but no one totally knows if it's completely true, but Mr. Rogers has also been asked and never denied it. But his car was stolen. And he came out, his car wasn't there. And he's like, alright, well, my car is stolen. And there's glass on the ground. The next day, the car is back with a note, because the people who stole the car found the puppets and the scripts and realized and looked at the registration and said, this is Mr. Rogers' car. So they replaced the window and wrote an apology note and returned the car.
Wow.
Because they said, we'll steal cars from pretty much anybody, but we're not touching this car. This is Mr. Rogers' car. There are so many, like, crazy little stories like that. But anyway, thanks for your attention. Thanks for coming out.